Our speaker today is Nicholas Vernola, founder of Ocean Medical Supply, which he sold to Henry Schein, a Fortune 298 company. And there he served as managing director of medical marketing until 2013. Nicholas earned a career entered a career in medical laboratory technology right after high school, but found the financial opportunities were mediocre at best in this field. So he worked in research for a while at Pfizer Drug Company and then transitioned to education, where he was a lab instructor at City University of New York. He then decided to enter medical sales, the field where he spent the remainder of his career, spanning 40 years working for Coulter Electronics, VWR Trek, and Diagnostic Technology before founding Ocean Medical Supply in 1988. Nick is currently retired with his main home in the Polo Fields, a second home in New York City, and a third home in Vermont. Please welcome Nick Vernola.
Okay. I spent a lot of time trying to prepare an outline and a format, but it didn't work. So my wife said, just get up there and talk about yourself like you do when you have company. So a little bit of my background of where I came from. I was born in a place called Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan. The name was given to it because of it was always something bad brewing there in the 1940s and 1930s. Famous characters that you know came from Hell's Kitchens, like Mario Puzo, who wrote The Godfather. Robert De Niro was from there, and Mickey Spillane was from there. And there's a whole list of other people, but you can see the trend of the type of characters that, came from the neighborhood. I was born into an Italian family that was not wealthy. I lived in a third tenement walk-up apartment where we shared bathrooms with other families, and when somebody needed to take a bath, everybody got out of the apartment, and there was newspapers put down on the floor, and you washed by the kitchen sink. With that, I was about 3 years old when my mom and dad decided that we needed to move to the country. This was not a place to bring up a family. They wanted to have another child. They eventually did. That was my brother. That was 5 years later. But they needed to get us out of New York City. So we moved to the country. And the country, for me, even as a kid, until the age of 5 years old, it was beautiful. There were snakes. There were frogs. There were tall trees like the ones you see here in the Polo Field. There was no school in the neighborhood. We didn't have a school. We had dirt roads. No sidewalks. Houses were spaced about an acre apart. So, you know, some people had larger, we had beautiful farms. And, you know, I could remember playing in front of the house even at the age of 3 and 4 years old and thinking how great it was to be able to just walk out the door. And you couldn't do that in the city. And I remember, I was 5 years old. The first school was built close enough for me to be able to walk to. And when I got into school, the teacher would take us up. It was a three-story building. She would take us up to the third floor, and we would look out over this flat land with trees that went up to this huge body of water, and it was just a wonderful place to live. And I was 5 years old, and I was in kindergarten. By the time I graduated high school, which was at the age of 17, Brooklyn was the fourth largest city in America.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so this is the timeline of a life that I lived through. And I can't believe that I actually witnessed this. And I look at moving to Cumming as going back to that. And don't think it's so far away. Within a span of 11 to 15 years, this whole area could turn into what Brooklyn looks like today. I'll tell you a little bit about what happened and how I got into medicine. It happened very early in my life. My mother died when I was 9 years old from brain cancer. And I remember the day she died in our living room. I sat there and I said, I'm going into medicine and I'm not going to let this happen to people. I'm going to figure out a way that people are not going to get sick. And, you know, it's a very noble thing for a child of that age to think. And as you get older, you realize you can't do anything like that. You can help. And I certainly lived up to the legacy that my father said was going to happen. He said that I was a very annoying kid because once I got on something, I never stopped. And just by the looking at my hobbies, you'll see that I started collecting trains when I was 3 years old. I still do that today. And I started playing the accordion when I was 10. And while I did go on a hiatus, I started playing the accordion after probably about 30 years. I started playing when I moved into the polo fields last year again. But the thing about medicine for me, I went into a medical career, and it actually saved my own life. Many people that know me don't know that I am a cancer survivor. And had it not been for my own education, I might not be here speaking today. When I was about 40 years old, I diagnosed myself with a non-symptomatic prostate cancer. And at 40, that's very, very early to get prostate cancer. And having no symptoms and no blood test results to show that you should even be looked into, I still found out that I had it because of the background I had, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. As mentioned, I did work for Pfizer in research, and I did go into medical sales eventually. I worked in, I became a supervisor of a microbiology lab, so all of my background in medicine was around diagnosis. I was not a physician, I was not a doctor. I did spend some time in pharmacy school, but quite frankly, my academics, I could not handle it. After a year, I dropped out. I went on to school to become a medical laboratory technologist, and again, the income was very limiting. I could make a little bit more money than a waiter or a waitress in a restaurant, and that was after going to school and learning things. So I went into research. I worked for Pfizer, and I also worked in education. I became a laboratory instructor. But I want to say I'm self-educated, and I am to the extent of the fact that I did a lot of enrolling myself in whatever opportunities there were to learn about more about diagnosis, blood results, x-ray, whatever tests were done. I wanted to learn about how to assimilate that information and produce enough evidence to show that there is a disease. A lot of people don't know that medical testing in most cases is the process of elimination. It's you do a test and say, oh, it's not this, and you do another test and it's not this, and prostate cancer is certainly one of those things. So what happened to me was over the years working in research and working in a clinical laboratory settings in a university and teaching and observing blood testing results, I learned that physicians mostly pay attention to the normal, abnormal column. And you go to a doctor and he says, well, look, here, everything on your blood test is normal except these outliers here are showing that you're just slightly elevated or, and then they put that in your chart and they go away. Well, what happened to me was at the age of 35, I decided I was going to start baselines of myself, of what my blood results were, my urine results, everything. And I did establish these baselines. And what physicians do not pay attention to, in most cases, there are some, and I've met a few that do, is the velocity of change. Velocity of change is more important than the actual number itself, and that's what happened to me. My prostatic antigen went up from 1 year to the next of 10%. And yet, it was still normal. And the doctor told me, you're normal. I said, well, let me see the result. He handed me it, and I said, well, it's up 10% from last year. He said, it could be artifactual. The lab could have had a bad day on the machine. I said, but you're about to tell me that I'm normal. I mean, you know, I need to know more about this. He said, well, what do you want me to do? I said, well, first, let's redo the test. And then after that, we'll decide. So we did the test. It came out positive. You know, it came out with the same number, not positive, still normal. And and we went on to find out that he said, well, what's the next? I said to him, what's the next step? He said, well, we'll do an ultrasound. So they did an ultrasound. There was nothing there. He says, we're done. I said, no, we're not. I said, I want to have what's the next step after this? And he said, well, it would be an MRI, but your insurance company's not going to pay for it. I said, I don't care. I want it done. So I went and had an MRI done, and the MRI was negative. So it went back to him. He says, now that's it. I said, no, what would be the next step? He said, a biopsy. But you have nothing to biopsy. There's no target. The MRI says there's no tumor. I said, I don't care. Do a random sampling. Well, Jesus was there for me because they did a random sampling. And look at the prostate as a peach and them sticking a needle into it, okay? Six times is what they did. And one of those needles picked up three cells that were cancer cells that had not yet formed a tumor. And it's called a microscopic focus. And I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. I had it, and I went down and had it removed at Johns Hopkins. So basically, that's my story of how I stayed alive. And I'm still trying to stay alive. So every day I'm, you know, thinking about what should I do next? That's a crazy way to live. But anyway, so I went on and I started, I worked in the business and I got into medical sales. And I always wanted to be in sales. I always felt like I had the personality to work in sales. It was very risky because I had to leave a job with 19 paid holidays, 8 weeks vacation, pension, and health care for the rest of my life. I worked for the City University of New York. It was a wonderful job. I made more money than most of my friends working in the job. And my father said that salesmen were alcoholics and womanizers, and I should not even consider going into it. So against his advice, I went into it anyway. I quit my job. I took a sales position. I did very well for the first 3 years. I did well for the rest of my life, actually. Never stopped. But it proved to be a very interesting career because I didn't really stop learning. I worked in clinical diagnosis for my whole life, in sales. Everything I did was around blood testing, urine testing, any bodily fluids or even tissue analysis or whatever. And I became so well-versed in medicine from the sales job. I didn't see myself just as a salesman. I saw myself as an expert. And what I did was I went into my own business, and the business started off, you know, Heinz mentioned the name of the company was Ocean Medical Supply. It first started off as Ocean Scientific, because what I did was I went out and sold products only for diagnosis, nothing else. I didn't want to sell any kind of medical supplies. I wanted to sell kits, machines, anything that did analysis of blood or whatever, to diagnose patients. You can see my childhood dream was to do that, and here I was. I was living out that dream. And it basically, what I did was, we started the company, and I would call on hospitals and their laboratories only. I would go into the hospital lab, I would speak to the pathologist, I would speak to the lab director, you know, we did well. I started selling a lot of these products that could test for different types of diseases. I spoke the language of the people in the lab. I could command their respect, unlike many other salesmen who walk in to sell something in a very canned speech of what their product can do that they were taught by their company. I had a more in-depth knowledge from everything I had done. And the company grew in the scientific area, and then I decided to offer my brother a job with the company and later on a partnership with me. If he would go out and call on doctors' offices and sell, he didn't have the background I had, so I said, you know, just go out and sell table paper and tongue depressors and exam tables and anything like that. And that's what he did. He came into the business, and he went out and he started calling on doctors. And once in a while, he'd come back to the offices. And at the time, what was happening was the doctors were looking for new income, which they always are, except now they're looking for ways to sell their practices to the hospital. But at the time, they were looking for ways to increase their income, so they were looking for ways to do testing in their office. So my brother would come back and say, do you know anything about this test? Yeah, I said, sure, what's the problem? He said, I have a doctor who wants to do one in his office. I said, well, make an appointment, I'll go see him. So I would go in and I would see them, and this happened very frequently, and before you know it, word of mouth, other physicians were calling us and having me go in and showing them how to do tests. So the business, we changed the name from Ocean Scientific to Ocean Medical Supply because now we covered everything. And then eventually the doctors start saying, what else do you sell? And we would start increasing our product line. I had to go out and get a pharmacy license so I can sell injectable drugs. And then I had to get a DEA license to sell controlled substances. So we sold morphine, Demerol. We started selling plastic surgery supplies, everything a plastic surgeon needs to do liposuctions and facelifts with resutures and everything. And I learned everything about all of these products that I had absolutely no knowledge of before we started the company. But I became well-versed in it. I became it just like everything I learned stayed with me my whole life. It just never went away. I was very fortunate, which means I'm probably going to get Alzheimer's disease. It just stayed with me, and the company grew. And after 24 years, we had a number of suitors, companies that were interested in buying us. They were all very large companies. Henry Schein is listed on NASDAQ. As mentioned, it's a Fortune 300 company, $8.6 billion in sales. But again, my path of life was planned for me. For some reason, the CEO of the company, of Henry Schein, his name is Stanley Bergman still today. He was the founder of, he wasn't the founder of the company, but he was the person that took the company from Henry Schein and brought it public and grew the company exponentially over the last 15 or 20 years. His wife was a physician. And one day, he was visiting her office, and he saw my company's calendar on her desk. Now, they were a competitor. And she said, why do you have that calendar on your desk? And she says, well, this company is, you know, my staff wants to buy from them. The guys from the company are so knowledgeable. They're so service-oriented. But we own Henry Schein. That's a bad advertisement. So we became a target of his acquisition. We lived in the shadow of the company. And what he did not know was his company helped start my company. And how that happened was that he had a president of his company at the time when I was starting my company who had called me up and asked me if I would do some consulting work for them. They were a mail order company only. We were a feet on the street company, and they were a mail order company. He said, would you do some consulting? We want to add some, you know, the trend is the physician wants to do testing in his office. Like I didn't know that. Would you come in here and show us how to get into the laboratory market? So I said, sure, absolutely. So I went in and met with them for the first time, and he said, this is what we want to do. Do you think it's the right thing? We want you to be a consultant. We want you to help us get some products in. And then, by the way, how much do you want to get paid? So I said, I don't want to get paid. He said, well, you know, I don't understand. What do you mean you don't want to get paid? There's got to be something that you want, you're going to get from this. I said, what I want you to do is sell me everything out of your warehouse at cost. And I'll come in as many times as you want in a month to go over the things that you need to do or the jobs that you need to have done. Because I realized how big they were. And what they had in their warehouse was probably a lower cost than I could actually ever hope to achieve getting from the vendors. So I would draw off their inventory and go out and sell to my customers on Long Island, which was where I was living now. Long Island is 130 miles long, 40 miles wide, and has 3 million people. By the time I sold my business, I owned all of the physician supply business, or the market share, probably around 75% of the business on Long Island. Now, it was because of the fact that there were 7 competitors on that island, not just Henry Schein. There was 6 other mom-and-pop-sized businesses like mine, but again, much bigger than mine. And by the time I sold to Schein, they were all gone. I was the only one left. And it was because I was able to draw off Shine's inventory and compete price-wise with everything they were doing, and they couldn't understand how I was doing it. Nobody knew it. So not getting paid for something is sometimes the best thing to do. And we grew the business to about $12 million in sales, and then we started entertaining talks with Stanley Bergman. And you'll see Stanley on MSNBC. You'll see him on Fox Network. He's often on TV and being interviewed about the success of the largest flu vaccine distributor in the world. That's who they are. And the contract, when we did sell to them, we had gotten a number of offers from a company in Jacksonville, another company in North Carolina. We really wanted to sell to Henry Schein because I wanted a transition. I didn't want to just sell the business and leave. I wanted to work there, and I didn't want to move off Long Island. So we sold the business to Henry Schein, and I remember the day of selling the business. I was sitting in this Madison Avenue law office and with this beautiful view of Manhattan, and I watched. I was actually able to watch what happens in mergers, and I was sitting at this table with a whole bunch of lawyers, and you know, you're signing a paper at a moment, a button is being pushed to transfer the funds into your personal account, and you know, all of a sudden became a lottery winner. I mean, basically, that's what happened. And you know, I would never have the opportunity to experience this if I stayed with my original profession of being a medical laboratory technologist. But one of the things that I learned, Stanley Bergman, when I did finally decide to retire, they had made me the director of medical marketing for the company, and in the 5 years that I stayed with them, I still do consulting work for them. I work a couple of hours a day doing a couple of jobs for them, which doesn't amount to much except some spending money. When I left, he did an exit interview with me, and he said, Nick, he said, you know, we're both CEOs. We're both, you know, different levels. But he says, tell me what your insights, and I won't hold anything against you. You could say whatever you want. So I said, you know, Stanley, I have one big disappointment in my life, and that was that I worked for you for 5 years, and I learned a lot about your company. I said, and when I was out there as your competitor, I did have some pride in what I was able to do. I was so proud that in the shadow of a Fortune 300 company, I was able to build my business. And I always credited myself with what a great job I was able to do. But after working here, I realized that was not such a great accomplishment. There was so much wrong, and there is so much wrong in that company. But it's not just that company. It's public corporations. It's just the way they are run. They make money because they have money. They can afford to make all the mistakes they want. They can afford to take all of the gambles they want. When you have $400 or $500 million in retained earnings, you can afford to make a lot of mistakes. Eventually, even if you make 10 mistakes, one of them is going to pay off. When you're a small company, every penny you make is important because you could be put out of business by making a one penny mistake. And Henry Schein was a good final end of my career to realize that being in my own business was the only place I should have spent my life. And coming here to Georgia, I was very fortunate to have a young gentleman knock on my door one night and set me in the right direction. And he's sitting in this room today. And while I followed Christianity for my whole life, I will say followed. I just barely was behind it. And I told Stephen one time that, you know, being in New York, we had many people selling religion knock on our doors and trying to get us to go to their churches. And one of the funny things I said today to Heinz is that when I lived in New York, you know, we had a lot of that. Most of it were, we would have the Jehovah's Witnesses would they do a lot, a real good job of canvassing in New York, and they're knocking on your door once a week at least. And it got to the point where I had to develop a way of handling it where I said, you know, when they would knock on the door, I said, I'm sorry, I'm Italian. We don't like any witnesses. So it was a way for me to make light of a situation that was getting to be quite annoying. But, yeah, that's basically the story of how I went from tenement to the polo fields. I think one of the most important things that happened in my life, for two reasons, one you already have assimilated, and that was when my mother passed, it put me in a direction. It was the Lord saying, it's time for Mom to come home, but there's a reason for it. You know, you're going to establish a path in your life for this. And it did that for me. But it also, I think what it did is it gave me strength. Not having a mother has the same effect of having a mother if you use it the right way. In that there was nobody there to give me direction. There was nobody there to pat me on the back when I drew a circle on a piece of paper and say, wow, that's beautiful. There was nobody to do that. So everything I did was all self-driven. And it got me through life. It gave me the strength I have. It made me the person I am today. And it started it at a very early life. My hobbies, what do I do now? I'm building a model railroad in my home here in the Polo Fields on Polo Hill. I have a 30 by 40 foot layout, and anybody who would like to see it is welcome to come over. The hobby of model railroading is considered the world's greatest hobby because there are so many different aspects of it. It's artwork, it's electronics, now computerization, it's history. If you look at the engine that's on the table over there, that's called an Allegheny, and named because its first operation was to carry coal over the Allegheny Mountains. That engine, in real life, the prototypical model of that engine, it cost $230,000 to build, which today would cost millions of dollars if it was built today. But it has the power of 18 diesel electric motors. Of today, it would take 18 engines to pull what that one engine could pull. So these are the types of things you learn about railroading when you have the models. It's just the electronics. You see, I have the trains going around the table. They're being monitored by a computer, which is allowing one to pass and the other one to stop. And it's a great thing for me because when I have people come over to visit in the past, before I had that, I would have to watch the trains and wind up crashing them eventually. So I set up the computer to accommodate that. And the accordion, I brought it with me today basically not to play it, but to show you what has been done with accordions. That's again, a lost art. Except down here, I'm seeing there are more accordions in country music now and Cajun music you're seeing. And there's some rock bands that do have accordions. This accordion is a non-reed accordion. There's no reeds in it. Mostly accordion is a reed instrument, like a horn, where you squeeze it and the bellows produce the air that go across the reeds and vibrate and create the sound. But this accordion is totally electronic. Every sound in it is recorded. There are saxophones, banjos, guitars, and it's not synthesized. Many people say, "Oh, it's like one of those keyboards." Keyboards mimic the sound of a saxophone or a banjo. It's very similar, but this is actually the sound of a saxophone. You will hear you if you were not facing the instrument, you would think that it is a saxophone playing. That's it. I guess my time is...
Tell us about your three locations.
The three locations. Okay, yeah. We have When we moved to Georgia, again, spending 66 years in the Northeast in New York, it was quite challenging mentally to be able to pick yourself up and move out. So what happened was we came down here just after we sold the business. And my brother had already moved here. And on our visit, we said, you know, this looks like a good place to retire, so let's buy a house. While we were here, we bought the house in the Polo Fields. We left it empty for 2 years. And as time got closer to moving down here, I started getting nervous about moving down here. So I said to my wife, let's buy a condo in New York City. So we bought a condo in New York City. My daughter still lives there. My daughter is she graduated from State University in New York with a degree in international marketing and fashion. And she worked for a company in their headquarters in the fashion district known as Cole Haan, if some of you might know who they are. And buying the condo would also give us the ability to visit her with extended stays. And we bought her a place also about 7 blocks away from where we are. The house in Vermont that we have was a remnant of my children's childhood. They're now in their mid-20s. We built the house in 2000 to take them skiing and go there as often as we possibly can. And as mentioned before, getting to Vermont from Long Island would be horrible if we had to drive around. But for us, it was a 1 hour and 15-minute ferry ride. We were in Bridgeport. And then from the minute we got off the ferry to the minute we got to our door was 3 hours, and it was all highway. There was one stop sign between the ferry and the house. And it made owning a house up there a lot better. The house in Vermont is something we still own and are on the fence about keeping. We're probably going to eventually sell it. And the place in Brooklyn, New York, will stay there. We're right on the other side of the bridge from Manhattan, and we just jump on the subway or Manhattan in minutes, and it's a great place to be when you want to be there. And, you know, for me, I like to go there for shorter periods than my wife does, but so that's good because I can get on the plane and come home and leave her there. that's it. That's the story of that.
Any other questions?
Quick question. You alluded to it, and if it's too personal, I understand, but you talked about the person knocking on your door here and selling religion up there. Can you sort of expound upon that?
Sure. I was a Roman Catholic, as most Italians are, so I always consider myself the first Southern Baptist Italian. you know, when we got down here, my wife and I did attend church frequently in New York, and interesting story, when Stephen knocked on our door that night, I guess it was just the right time, because we had just gotten here, and we were ready to see what we were going to do. We had been to the Roman Catholic Church here a couple of times, and it was just a continuation of everything that we had done, and I guess over my life, having been to religious instructions and all of that, we enjoyed the Christianity through the Catholic Church in the way we did, but Stephen gave us such a good story that I said, you know what, Stephen, you could bear me out. Then I say, give me your best shot, I'll come to one of your services. Tell me which one you want me to come to. I can't guarantee you I'm going to keep coming, but I will try. And we did. He suggested that we come to a Sunday school session. And we went, and we really, really, really had an awakening by Pastor Baines and saying, wow, that was powerful. Now I'm starting to understand there's more to it than we really knew. I didn't understand everything because of that one Sunday school session, but I did understand, I had the ability to say, there's more to this. We've learned about the Bible. We never read it. We learned about what its preachings were, but we never read them. We learned everything in the form of what you're supposed to do to be good and what you're supposed to be doing to be bad, if you want to be bad. You know, I remember Stephen's question is, do you know that you are going to heaven? And I said, no, but neither do you. And, you know, and I learned why he asked that question, and it kept us going to the Berrien Church. We, my wife and I still go there, and we still actively participate in everything we possibly can. We learned about giving, you know, the I gave up the take and you shall receive. You know, basically, that's how I lived my whole life. And we see people that need help. And my wife has always been a very giving person. And I think the church made me more so and made her even more so. So, yes, sir.
This is not my question, Nick, but is it okay if I tell my New York Catholic wife about you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You
know,
you can get her to see me.
We're just on the horizon of a fair tax, I know, but have you ever considered being an income tax consultant?
An income tax consultant? No. No, that's not something I'm really good at because I don't like to lie.
It sounded like you broke the code, though, in getting your cost of goods and so forth.
Yeah, well, getting the cost of goods was totally legitimate. They knew what I was doing with it. The funny thing that Stanley Bergman, who is now the CEO, when I told him the story, because he didn't know. You know, a CEO of a company is so removed from the daily day-to-days of the business, especially a company that size. And At the end, I told him that story, and I said, you know, Bob, your president at that time, made this deal with me. He says, yeah, that's why he's no longer with us. But, yeah, everything I did was legitimate. Finally, a lot of things, you know, when I look in my life now, not just now because I passed it, but now because of going to the Berrien Church, I look back as a boat leaving a wake. And you look behind you at that wake and see that it went around obstacles. And you might want to credit yourself for having the vision to get around those obstacles, but it wasn't. It was a divine intervention.
Yes.
Because everything that happened positive for me can't be a coincidence. And the fact that we're all here today, think about the one in skadillion chances of you being here to hear me speak. It's impossible that there isn't something else. And we know what that something else is. So that's it.
Anything else? Okay, great.
Wow, what a great story! And you know, the one of the things that I think we all kind of wrestle with—you probably don't, but I do—and that is blind spots. And those are positions we hold and certain things that we don't see the problem with them. But a lot of times, everybody else can. And when you poke at my blind spot, I'll defend it. I won't try to listen to the reason behind that. In fact, I almost took a company, my current company, under because I had a blind spot. But the way that I've learned to best have blind spots revealed to me is when someone else tells their story. That's one of the reasons I have such a passion for this breakfast and the Norcross Fellowship Luncheon, where men actually share their faith and how that works in the marketplace. But I learned so much when someone talks about their life, because it's not threatening to me or pushing my buttons, it's simply somebody else's story. And I've learned a lot today, and I learn a lot every time we come here, and I hope it helps you in your life journey too. We don't have any ulterior motives here other than just having a man share his life and what he's learned. And again, if any of you feel comfortable in doing that yourself. I've already heard a lot of interesting things about you, so I know you've got a good story. So think about maybe sharing your life story too. So thanks again for coming. Great job, Nick. And have a cup of coffee and hope to see you in November, I think. So thank you.